Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
It's March 22nd, 1964, and another remarkable event is about to be uncovered by Aria, Rebecca, and Ollie, the Retrospectors.
Whenever we visited SeaWorld on holiday, my dad used to feel uneasy about eating fish and chips there. Watch the show, then eat the ones who failed the audition, he'd say. But in fact, this ocean-based theme park, which opened today in history in 1964, sprang from the initial concept of a themed restaurant with a marine show inside. When that became too expensive, the founders pivoted and built a seaquarium instead.
Yeah, and the moment the gates opened at 10 a.m., according to the San Diego Union Tribune, thousands of San Diegans who had waited about as long as they could stand it for the opening of the $4.5 million marine park swarmed through the gates. The opening was somewhat marred by the decision of some of the invited dignitaries, including the mayor of San Diego, Frank Curran, to pull out because the park was being picketed by labor unions as part of an industrial dispute and they didn't want to be photographed crossing a picket line. Those who did attend include Senator Barry Goldwater, just launching his ultra-conservative presidential campaign. For those who did choose to attend the grand opening, though, they were greeted by a fleet of sea maids to help them navigate the 22 acres, while waitresses in tropical get-up served drinks in the refreshment area. It was 1964, after all.
Yeah, I mean, the popularity is explicable when you consider that the sea was pretty mysterious back then. Encounters with local marine life was a rare and intriguing kind of experience that you just couldn't get at a regular zoo. There were plenty of zoos, but they were all about land-dwelling mammals and reptiles. But this was a thing that was like something totally different to anything you'd seen before.
Although it's really not a straightforward seaquarium and never was SeaWorld. You have to remember this was devised in the late 1950s when suddenly you had this explosion in leisure time and an economy in America willing to invest in interstate tourism. You had the incredible success of Disneyland. 5 years later, four frat brothers, Milton Shedd, Ken Norris, David DeMott, and George Millay, came up with the idea of melding together Shedd's interest in the nautical world with amusement parks and went around seeking investments for something that was always this slightly uncomfortable mash of education and conservation with performance.
Yeah, Ken Norris was the serious fish guy. He was a zoologist who had been curator of Marine Land of the Pacific, which had opened in 1954 and was basically the first aquarium theme park mashup. He was later a professor of natural history at the University of California. As you mentioned, Shedd also
liked to fish.
Yeah, I mean, he stayed at SeaWorld. He would spend 20 years as its chairman. He was a leading figure in marine conservation. But Millay was the entertainment mogul. He had actually already launched a Polynesian-themed restaurant in 1958. We've talked a bit before about the craze in the 50s for tiki bars, Hawaii, tropical island culture generally. And he was the one who actually initially thought about perhaps even having an underwater restaurant. Although, as you can imagine, they soon realized there was no way this was going to be feasible without an insane amount of money and work. But it was then that they learned that San Diego City Council were looking for proposals for a site which they wanted to turn into a marine amusement park, something that would compete with Disneyland, which had opened in Anaheim, which was only 100 miles away. And they thought San Diego, a boom town at the time, is ripe for something like that. And the four businessmen's initial proposal was for what they called Marine Park. And the draft they submitted was a product of pure early 60s futuristic fantasy. It painted a wildly improbable but very exciting picture of fruity Polynesian girls riding on turtleback and 20-foot pilot whales carrying troops of dutifully compliant penguins on their backs.
Yeah, so basically, you know that Polynesian theme bar you did? That, but the pretty hula girls are at risk of being eaten by a shark. It's brilliant. Yeah. I'd go to that.
But, you know, in 1961, no one even knew whether sharks or killer whales could survive in captivity, let alone be trained to perform in the way that they came to be trained to perform. And ultimately, the San Diego commissioners went for it. You can understand why, because something like what was being proposed, kind of a mishmash of the two proposals, which was what SeaWorld came to be, was just hugely titillating.
What visitors weren't going to see on this opening day was what SeaWorld would later become famous for, killer whales and sharks. On this day, the attractions consisted of dolphins, sea lions, and saltwater fish. This tiki craze that we've mentioned before was still apparent. The park included a Hawaiian punch village featuring tropical decor and tiki-style cocktails. And elsewhere, there was a mock Japanese village where you could watch pearl divers in action, which doesn't sound super exciting, but was apparently one of the main attractions. And despite the lack of orcas, 400,000 visitors flocked to the park during the first year.
Yes, I mean, it's notable that on this day in 1964, this park opened to great fanfare, but without their big star, Shamu. Because it wasn't until June 1965 that a man called Ted Griffin, who was the owner of the Seattle Marine Aquarium, purchased Namu, who was a 22-foot-long killer whale, for $8,000, captured for him by British Columbia fishermen because he had... I mean, you can't say this with a straight face, really. It's amazing how it became part of mainstream entertainment for so many decades. He had a fantasy of riding a killer whale in the manner of an aquatic stallion. And he was able to achieve that fantasy by buying this orca and bringing it to Seattle. Thousands of onlookers lined bridges and docks to see it arrive and cheered as it did. It was on the front page of every newspaper in the Pacific Northwest. And he developed a relationship as a trainer with this whale in which he was encouraging the orca to do tricks that human beings had never seen before, or certainly not in the United States anyway, where, you know, a person could ride on the whale's snout. He taught them behaviours, which actually I always did think, as someone who visited SeaWorld as a kid, were natural behaviours. I realised, obviously, that killer whales aren't supposed to be in performing shows in tanks.
Kissing people in the face.
Yeah. No, things like the mid-air somersault, I thought must be something that whales do naturally. It's just that they're encouraging to do it with food or whatever. But no, all of that was stuff that he taught whales to do. And he developed, as I say, this relationship where he said in his memoir, "I loved Namu passionately, perhaps with the same capacity and energy that often exists between women and men." But in this kind of Barnum-like spirit, bigger, better, American, let's do another one, he then went and got a second whale, a 14-foot female orca that he trapped himself. And the hope was to establish a breeding program in Florida. But the whales weren't interested in getting it on. He'd suddenly bitten off more than he can chew. He had two orcas to look after. And that's how SeaWorld acquired secondhand the female partner to Namu, which they called Shamu.
Yeah, and this was kind of the beginning of that friction between what SeaWorld actually was. You know, was it a marine conservation program, or was it basically a fairground where you could come and point and laugh and gasp as you saw performing whales? Marine Land of the Pacific had actually turned down Shamu. They had been offered the chance to buy Shamu, but they turned it down on the grounds that a killer whale could not be kept in captivity long term. SeaWorld, by taking on Shamu, proved that it could be done, but did start to raise that question that would only become louder and louder of, should it be done?
Yeah, at SeaWorld, Shamu had to eventually be retired after biting a staff member riding on her back and not letting go until trainers pried her jaws open with a metal bar. She then died 4 months later after only 6 years in captivity. But by this stage, you know, SeaWorld was this absolute juggernaut. They ultimately went on to open four different parks in the US, but they became a victim of their own success. You know, the very awareness of and empathy for the animals that were being displayed was kind of instrumental in raising what would ultimately be the concern that that generated the backlash, not only to the capture of wild orcas and then their training and display, but also to the park itself. But still, the business model was very much resting on the fact that they had this huge number of orcas at the exact same time as lots of people were believing that orcas shouldn't be part of anyone's business model.
And, you know, you had walk-around animal costumes, people dressed as baby Shamu with legs, you know, having photos taken with tourists. Orcas were the logo of SeaWorld. You went to see the orcas. So it is no surprise, really, that as concern grew throughout the 90s, you remember Free Willy, and then into the noughties, particularly, I guess, peaking with Blackfish, the documentary that CNN aired in 2013, the concept was just completely inextricably linked in the public mind. You know, if the problem is orcas, then the problem is SeaWorld.
So Blackfish revolved around the death of trainer Dawn Branshaw, who was pulled under the water at SeaWorld Orlando in 2010 and killed by an orca called Tillicum. But the general gist of the documentary was that Tillicum had acted in this way because of the unnatural conditions in which the orcas were kept in captivity at SeaWorld. And 3 years after the release of the documentary, SeaWorld announced, this was in 2016, that the current generation of orcas at the park will be the last. I mean, there will be orcas for some time to come because they do live quite a long time. But that was a huge step for a chain which has really built its entire identity on being the place you go to see killer whales. I mean, there's definitely an argument that SeaWorld has done some undeniable good, that the park's veterinary team have been responsible for the rescue and rehabilitation of hundreds of thousands of injured or stranded animals over the years. In 2015, the team rescued almost 1,000 sea lions from mass stranding in California. So there's definitely a case being made that there has been some positive impact. It's just whether or not that balances out the mistreatment of animals kept in unnatural captivity to perform in front of crowds of, you know, baying visitors.
It also depends which animal rights you value as well, because for every orca you introduce to San Diego, you kill a lot of seagulls.
Yeah.
And so another week of retrospecting ends. But next week begins a day early at Club Retrospectors. Join us now to get an exclusive episode every Sunday. Patreon.com/retrospectors.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.